Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Pony Sync for the 22nd of March. Let's get down to it. So just before the call, we were talking about in the RFC's issue number 56, not pull request, but issue number 56, which is on exhaustive match and unreachable cases. And Joe has an implementation, which is pretty cool. And he's going to write up an RFC, and then we'll get it merged. And yeah, just so everybody knows, that's on its way. So going to RFCs, let's have a look at some of these things. Let's start with number 84, arrays as sequences. So it looks like this has gone through final comment. Are we ready to merge this?
Yeah, I think so.
Awesome. Right. Merging. Done. All right, in which case, I'm going to pop over to the repo. Oops. And make a little note for myself. To PR arrays as sequences, because the implementation is actually already done, which is nice. Okay. Next step. Let's look at explicit partial calls, number 82. So the last thing that we were talking about is Benoit was having a look at how this would impact his idea for how to do typed and valued exceptions, basically turn partial functions into more Java C-sharp style exceptions. Benoit's not here, so I think maybe we ought to put this one off. I've been talking to a bunch of people as I can steal their attention about this and where they think this ought to go. And it's been an interesting set of conversations that I've had at work about this. The guy who has had the biggest impact on my thinking, somewhat predictably, is Don Syme, who's the inventor of F-sharp. And I was saying to him that I was very worried about non-local returns, and he was saying, yeah, but in the presence of a catch clause, which is essentially what else is, right? It allows us to catch, but it catches anything. You're essentially allowing non-local returns anyway. It's just non-local returns without information. Well, that's not really that different from normal exceptions, right? Normal exceptions where you know they attach a string to it or something, and hey, no one pays attention to the damn value of that thing anyway. So it's, yeah. I don't know, I'm rambling a little bit, but basically what I'm trying to say is maybe I'm not so opposed to this as I thought. And on the other hand, maybe I'm even more opposed to it because there, even the what we have, the existing way, gives more non-local return behavior than maybe we really want. So there you go. How's that for very, very fuzzy, muddled thinking? Yeah. I think moving the error type, as Benoit said, is, yeah, both of the solutions that Benoit has there are a little bit odd, so I don't know. Does anyone else have any thoughts on the syntax of this thing? It seems like we're all pretty much agreed we should do this thing, and it's just really a question of syntax at this point. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, right now I'm kind of at the point of, I kind of weakly prefer the having the question mark being after the parentheses,
okay,
as written up in the main RFC, and as would be more compatible with Benoit's RFC. but I know that you're kind of in the other position. You kind of prefer a little bit to have the you and Sean have expressed some preference in having the question mark being right after the identifier.
Yeah. I suspect the reason it's me and Sean is that old lisp habits die hard. And it's a bit more lispy to have it right there with the identifier. That's not a reason that, you know, we should be listened to in any way, shape, or form. Yeah, so there you go.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's my opinion is mainly about, like, the in the method signature. When you're looking at the method signature, I think it kind of, I mean, so right now we've got the privacy or publicness of the method is already kind of tied up in the identifier.
Yep.
That kind of makes sense. It's like, you know, I can't reach this identifier if it has this kind of name, which kind of makes sense. That's kind of like a precondition to calling.
Yeah, it's implicit namespacing.
Right. But to me, it kind of, the question mark is kind of less like that, in that it seems like it's like less like belonging there and more belonging as like the right hand side of the parentheses, or, you know, talking about like how it can return. It can return this value, or it can, you know, raise an error. And I think that is, I think those two, the return value and the question mark, I think they do sort of belong together conceptually in my head, but maybe, I don't know.
I agree. And I think in some ways that's the core of what makes me uncomfortable about exceptions at all, is that you're absolutely right. It's a return value. And it's a non-local return value. And, you know, as I keep saying, that makes me nervous. I'm a broken record. Sorry about that. Yeah, but you're right. I'm in a strange way agreeing. Have we looked at how it would impact the parser to stick question marks as call suffixes?
No, I haven't. I haven't tried implementing either option of being after the identifier or after the parentheses. It kind of seems to me like the question mark isn't used for anything else within a.
It's totally fine. I just tried it.
Value.
I just tried it both ways. It's fun.
Okay.
No problem at all. Which is good. Which is very good. Yeah, excellent.
Yeah, my only concern with having the question mark after the parentheses is, like, how would that look with call chaining?
Yeah, so it would come after the parentheses and before the dot or the dot arrow or things like that. That's an interesting thought. I had not thought of that. That is worth at least just fiddling with the syntax and seeing how we feel about it.
Because I feel like if you're calling a function, like the actual, like, calling the result of that, or like chaining the receiver forward, that would be like a separate concept from, like, will it return? Like, could it throw an error or something?
That's interesting.
Although, I do feel like it's kind of natural in that position. You know, you do end up with, like, question mark dot, which I think in at least one other language that became, like, sort of a different kind of call operator, and that might be confusing to some people. I think, I use Ruby at work, they added recently the question mark dot as a way of saying, call this method if the left-hand side is not nil, otherwise just return nil, which is...
That's actually not totally different from what we're talking about. because
yeah, it's not totally different, but yeah, I think it's horrible in their case. But yeah,
yeah, fair enough. There have been several Java-like languages that have done that recently as well.
Kotlin's doing a lot of that.
Yeah, exactly. And I think some of the other ones, the names of which, Ceylon, I think maybe has something like that.
Kotlin's a bit of a mess. It has like bang dot question mark dot, like all these.
Yeah.
These strange things.
Yeah. I'm always reminded of the Pope hat operator. That there's a joke about an operator that looks like the Pope if you were laying on his side, which, you know. But I'm sorry, I'm just fiddling with writing stuff right now. I have a tendency around the dot arrow to put spaces around it for some reason, which is not necessarily normal. And
I've been doing that too, actually.
Oh, okay. And when I do, the question mark looks totally fine. On the other hand, I don't tend to put spaces around the dot. And when I leave it without, bizarrely, I didn't think I would say this, the question mark still looks normal to me. But please do fiddle with it, because, yeah, I think that's an important one to think about. On the other hand, I'm leaning towards just saying, hey, what the heck, let's just stick it after the parents, and there's yeah, I don't know. Tell you what, Theo, fiddle with it just a little bit while we're on the call, and let us know how you feel in 10-15 minutes of looking at it.
I've actually been fiddling with it like during this conversation. Actually, I think I'm actually fine with it being on the end of the parentheses. It doesn't look as weird as I thought it would.
I feel the same way. When you said that, I was like, oh yeah, that's going to be horrible. We can't possibly do it that way. And then I was trying it, and I was like, actually?
It's actually not bad, even with the call chaining.
It's really not bad. I'm kind of strangely
surprised.
Yes, exactly.
And, you know, like you said, it is kind of like a thing that if you're reading from left to right, you're like, you know, do this thing, you know, call this method, and then call this on the result unless it errored. Like, it's right. Sort of like, you know, if it errors, then fill out. Otherwise, call this next thing. It sort of kind of reads naturally from left to right. But
yeah. Yeah, I'm kind of sold on that. On the basis of that, I'm a little bit tempted to say, let's record a note that we're going to do it after the call and merge the PR.
It might be good to get Sean's input first. I don't know, just to check in.
Okay.
Because he also preferred option two, so it'd just be good to talk to him about it, I think.
All right. I'll mark this ready for vote, since there's an even more ready than final comment period, which I always forget about. And I'll put a little note. All right, I added a note and marked it ready for vote. Okay, next up, number 80, CLI format RFC draft. This seems like it's pretty ready.
Yeah, I think so.
Anyone think this isn't ready? Now people are like hanging out and chatting about all the cool things they could do with it, which is usually a sign that an RFC is ready. All right, cool. Let's go ahead and merge this one. Excellent. And I think the next one is number 85. So Sean was talking to me today about ways to replace system calls for testing. And I was saying, well, one thing that we could certainly do is write a primitive that effectively forwards to the FFI calls, parameterize the IO types on a trait that has the interfaces to do that primitive exposes, that defaults to that primitive as its implementation, which means we would still get the same static dispatch and inlining that we have now when you use the default, and it would allow plugging in an alternate implementation when you wanted to. But I think actually we would want to be able to plug in an alternate implementation that had mutable state, so that you could do things like plug in an object that was going to return some deterministic sequence of stuff as the input values to a supposed TCP connection, stuff like that.
And I haven't yeah, that's a good point. You'd expect it, and at that point, then you'd have problems with it being primitive, definitely.
Right. So at that point, I'm not exactly sure how to write that, but I think that's the right general idea of how to do it. I don't know that we have sort of ongoing funniness with objects where we don't care what the reference capability is on the object as long as we can call a specific method on it. In other words, we don't care if it's ref or val as long as we can call a method on it, but that method might need to mutate the object, right? So it can't be a box receiver method where we really don't care and it's no problem, right? And it feels like maybe that's the issue here. I'm not sure.
Yeah, well, maybe this is where specialization does it.
That's a good point.
Yeah, because you know, this is already, we're talking about making a type parameter. It could be a type parameter that accepts either a ref or a val or, you know, or a box or any read, basically, right?
And then specialized on the based on the basis of the reference capability and said, oh.
Could be ugly, though. Ugly potential bad ergonomics. I'm not sure. I'm not sure exactly how that would look.
Yeah, but I think it's worth looking into and getting right, because I agree that this would make a pretty darn cool testing methodology to be able to say, hey, it's no problem, just fire up my TCP connection with this different form of input and treat it as exactly the same, except that it's going to fake its own input.
Oh, here's an option of something that would let you return, like, you know, like you said, return a deterministic stream of, like basically the state would change over time, but without being ref, while still being val.
Yeah.
You could have the primitive, every function that you called on it, it would return itself in the base case, but in the one that you sub in with a deterministic stream, it would like return the next item in a immutable
classic functional programming thing. The problem is that it would mess up performance testing because it would be doing allocation. But maybe we'll
yeah, find- and I guess it also doesn't really work with type parameters because your type parameter isn't going to be able to change over time. I guess unless you, if you initialize it with that.
But it's okay. It would be a trait. You'd just say it's some trait and it's initialized with this one. But the field is a trait and is updatable.
Right. Okay.
The problem
then
the problem then is you wouldn't get the static dispatch on the case where you don't want things to change.
Yeah, which sucks.
Which sucks.
Because it's not a zero cost abstraction.
Right. So that's interesting. So I was just thinking as you were talking, there's another issue with it, which is it's not just the FFI, but also the notification that the TCP connection should be scheduled to run. So I wonder if what we actually want to abstract over is
The IO engine.
The IO engine.
Yeah.
The underlying IO engine that would then would do things like use a timer instead, but it would happen at that level where it was actually generating the event as well.
Yeah, I mean, and this kind of makes me come back to my sort of suggestion of maybe it's better just to try to shove all of the complicated logic of TCP connection into a class that can be invoked synchronously by like simulating. It's like you call this method to say, hey, I got this event.
Yep.
And you know, you grab the output of that to see what it did.
Yep. I think that's probably a really good idea. Funnily enough, I thought I was cheating when I first wrote the file implementation. I was like, okay, I just need the quickest, dirtiest, stupidest file implementation, and I'll make it synchronous, and it's terrible. It should be asynchronous. But actually, I think it should be synchronous because it's straightforward to write an actor around a file and say, if you want asynchronous behavior, make it asynchronous. It's really easy. It's not easy to make synchronous behavior out of an actor. In fact, it's not possible.
Yeah, and also there's a ton of important like performance related stuff that's been going on with TCP connection.
Okay.
Some of it might benefit UDP connection or process monitor or other things that deal with file descriptors.
That's true.
And if we had this reusable thing that you can plug into all those places, you've got a central place to fix up or improve performance of that logic.
Yep. That's a really good point.
And you have to easily test it.
Yeah. To the point where we could even imagine a situation where it was IO actor, right?
Yeah, like a public thing that somebody can use to create their own.
Wrap all kinds of stuff.
Which is something that, like, for example, when I've been writing some, I was experimenting with trying to figure out how you would do a good FFI connection to something that used a lot of like background threads in the library, which is something I always try to avoid, but I was really interested in what you might do. One of the patterns I was looking at is like communicating with the library over a file descriptor. Shoving a pointer in one end and reading it out the other end and all that stuff.
Gruesome, but effective.
And if it were, if that were wrapped up nicely, then it might not be so bad. But anyway, there are lots of cases where you could imagine the user wants to deal with file descriptors kind of on their own terms, but they also want all the benefits of having the tried and true logic that's been iterated on in TCP connection over years.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Yeah. So on the RFC itself, it looks fine to me. And I think maybe you should put it in final comment period. What do you think?
Yeah, probably. I mean, Sean can take it out if he doesn't want it to be, but yes.
Yeah, all right. Okay. I'm not quite... Yeah, it's a very subtle point about network performance in this RFC. So, yeah. But let's go ahead and mark it. Final comment period. Okay. Are there any other RFCs we should go over? Okay. In that case, let's go to the PRs, which I think we're pretty good on at the moment. So let's look at 1735. This is another Benoit change in the pool allocator as he's trying to clean up all this stuff. Just for background for people who don't know, it's not that the pool allocator was broken and that's why we're hacking on it. It's because he wanted to have multiple JITted programs start up, run, shut down everything, restart. And what was happening is when a pony program was exiting, it was happily allowing its scheduler threads to not clean up the memory they'd allocated, because why bother? Program is exiting. Don't take time cleaning up when the process is going to clean up for you. But in the case where you're doing multiple programs in a single, sequentially through a pony runtime, that was problematic. And so what he's done is gone through the work of figuring out how to hand back memory to the central pools, not to the operating system, but to the central pool allocator pools when a thread terminates. This is really, really good. So it's not only good for this particular case. It's good for a very interesting thing that I've been thinking about doing for a while, which is, imagine, if you will, a pony runtime running on 8 cores that has 8 scheduler threads running. And imagine that the runtime detects that one of those threads has been running the same message on the same actor for some very long period of time, where very long is, you know, some value that counts as very long, 10 milliseconds, whatever it is, long. And the runtime decides that thread is, that's a long lasting message, so long lasting that it's actually worth spinning up a new scheduler thread. And what it could do is spin up a new scheduler thread, steal all the pending work from that one. Actually, I'm not even sure you would have to steal all the pending work. Basically, pin yourself to the same core as the one that's long running and start stealing work and also running it and saying, okay, essentially, because it's long running, in order to free up the system, we're actually going to start sharing out that CPU. This could work particularly well if, for example, you bound to a hyperthread, if not all hyperthreads were in use initially. Like, for example, if you ran without the hyperthreads and you said, oh, well, I'm going to spin up a new one, I'm going to bind to a hyperthread. Anyway, this would let you then, when a thread that had been long running, it finishes, since there's another scheduler thread doing work on that core, you could terminate that thread and hand all the memory back, and it would be fine, and everything would proceed as before. And effectively, you would get per core cooperative multitasking as opposed to per process cooperative multitasking. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, that sounds pretty nice, especially like we were just talking about before with like somebody who's using synchronous IO like file. You could really make use of that core while you're waiting on IO from the file.
Exactly. Exactly. You can make perfect use of the core while you were waiting, which is kind of
cool. We don't have to give people as many warnings about like, hey, don't do that synchronous IO. You know, don't do it 8 times because you're screwed.
Well, even then you could imagine a situation where you just keep doing this. If all of the threads on a given core are long running and pause, spin up yet another thread. So you could end up with 14 threads running on a core if that's how someone wrote the program. Don't do that. Anybody listening to this in the future, don't do that.
Yeah.
But you can imagine that the runtime could theoretically cope with that if the operating system was okay with it.
Yeah, you just start running into a memory issue eventually.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah. I mean, you run into all the problems of thread allocation. And so there would have to be all kinds of interesting heuristics on it. And also things like, well, you'd want to think about, if we could, a way to examine if the operating system thinks that core is saturated or not. Because if the operating system thinks that core is saturated and we have a long-running thread, we don't want to spin up a new thread because we're doing computation on that thread, which is interesting and worth future investigation. All right, all that was a very long-winded way of saying, I'm sorry, that I think we ought to merge 1735. Everyone all right with that?
Yeah.
All right, cool. Merging. Yet another Benoit PR. Yay, Benoit. All right. Speaking of which, let's look at 1733, which is marked as needs discussion. I don't think Benoit's on the call, unfortunately. Hey, he is on the call. Benoit.
Yeah, I jumped in the middle of it.
Excellent.
The question on this PR, and actually it's linked to another. It's Deepin's PR number 1647.
Okay.
So the question here is, which one do we want to merge? So basically, the idea that Deepin had in his PR is to not commit all memory allocated from JRS at the same time, uh-huh. Because if we do that, we commit 128 megabytes of memory at yeah. once, and the system can run out of memory really quickly, especially with a high number of threads. And but the downside in his PR is that the runtime will now do more calls to a virtual alloc, basically on every allocation. So what I'm worried about in this PR is that it could lead to some slowdown because of the transition to kernel mode. So
yeah, that's going to be very, very slow, unfortunately.
Yeah, so my idea, which is in 1733, was to allocate less memory from the OS and to still commit that at the same time. So my change was to change pool mmap to 16 megabytes.
Ah, right. So that on Windows, you basically drop down to the 32-bit mmap size.
Yes.
Okay.
So I picked that number a bit arbitrarily, so I don't know if it's optimal or not. So yeah, the question is which one do we want to merge and
right. So theoretically on an 8-core machine, the maximum theoretical overcommit is a gigabyte, right?
Yeah.
At 128 megabytes per go.
Yes.
And on any Unix, the overcommit is zero because it just doesn't matter. It's untouched memory and nobody cares. Interesting. I lean towards your approach because those kernel calls are going to absolutely kill us for performance. I'm just having a quick look at the virtual alloc docs. So that commit does not allocate physical pages. So there's a reserve, which is an address space reservation. So what is it doing in commit that is, it's not physical pages and it's not just address space? What's the extra step that Windows is doing there? And what happens if you write to uncommitted memory? Does it force a commit? Does anyone know?
No, I'm really not a Windows expert.
Yeah, me neither. I'm just having a quick look at the docs here. Ah, there's some more on reserving and committing. Okay, so yeah. So you do indeed get an access violation on writing to non-committed memory. So that's not an option. So one of the things that people do apparently is set up a page fault filter that looks for exception access violation through SEH, structured exception handling. And when it encounters that, it goes and commits a page. But that's a bit... I really don't think we want to be doing that. Because we're talking about trying to catch page faults on arbitrary memory writes and things that we just don't want to do. Okay, let's merge 1733 and make comments on Dipin's PR explaining that the kernel transition is although it is better for memory usage, is too slow performance wise. And let's go with that. Benoit, could you make the comments on Dipin's PR?
Yeah, I'll do it.
All right, awesome. In which case, I'm going to go ahead and merge 1733. Assuming GitHub ever works. There we go. Yay, GitHub. Done. Okay. So 1726 got marked do not merge, but it looked so nice.
Sorry, I see. Which one?
The 1726 identity comparison of boxed values, and it seems it's failing both AppVeyor and Travis.
The problem this one is it's actually the memory allocation problems that were fixed that we hopefully fixed by merging the two PRs.
Ah, fantastic. So,
I just have a stray commit on the PR that I have to remove. Okay. So I'll do it after the call.
Excellent. Super good. That's great. I really like your scheme of using bit segregated type IDs. It's really nice. That's really, really good. Okay. In that case, 1723 is also failing, but it seems like maybe it did need some discussion about gen name type. Is that do you guys feel like that needs any discussion, or are you guys feeling okay about that?
Yeah, I just Benoit says that this is going to cause. This is something that you and I discussed earlier, Sylvan, about taking this approach. But Benoit says it might cause issues with gen name type. Do you know?
So gen name
you thought of.
Yeah. So gen name type is not used for as much stuff as you might think. It happens in gen header, but only for nominal types. It happens in gen type, but only for nominal types. That's actually gen name type in CAP, but you know, same difference. It does get called inside of gen name. In the sense that it does type append, right? That type append gets called for when building out names of generic types and things like that. And then perhaps that's an issue. We might get non-equivalents of generic types that otherwise we would get equivalents of. For example, if we had an array of string or stringable and an array of stringable, would we then end up with separate types?
The problem, let me see.
Because that would happen in reach
file. Yeah, it's the thing I was concerned about is that gen name. Well, the names generated by gen name are also used as the keys in
reach.c.
In reach. Yes.
Yeah.
So.
And it also comes into things like how you distinguish between different generic types and stuff, when really sometimes those should be the same generic type.
Is there any sorting going on anywhere? Because I didn't see any sorting. And in that case, if you had like an A or B, that would end up with a different gen name type than B or A, right? With or without my change.
That's interesting.
Like, I think, yeah, it seemed like the names weren't deterministic by sorting order already, so, yeah.
That's very interesting.
Maybe that's already a bug, or maybe that means that it's not a problem. I'm not sure which.
Yeah. but one of those two things is either broken or not a problem. Strange as it sounds, I think you're absolutely right. Like, that's funny and also true. And what I was thinking was then is that what if what we did was we did the flattening and possibly flattening and subtype checking, because that would solve the problem that you're talking about. What if we did it only in reach.c and therefore we'd only do it once for each instance of a union type that appeared in reach.c and not do it anywhere else?
Would that work to only would that be effective at achieving the goal of only doing it once per union type? Because if you, everywhere it's mentioned, it's a distinct AST node and would need to be flattened again, right? To test for equivalence. I'm not that familiar with the reachability process, so maybe I'm off, but.
No, that sounds right. That sounds right.
I mean, yeah. Maybe the better solution is to do the type alias, to remove type alias substitution until later, and then so you're only flattening, like if you create a type alias and use that type alias everywhere in your program, it's not flattening the union separately for all of those places.
Right. Well, and really we should get rid of type alias substitution, because getting rid of type alias substitution is going to give us recursive type aliases.
I started doing a branch of that, but it got hairy.
It's ugly. It's really ugly. Yeah.
Yeah. So I was looking for an easier way out.
Yeah. You know what? If we have a few test cases around this, maybe the gen name stuff is not so bad. And maybe we should have a go at that and see if there's some stuff with generic parameters and see if it's coming up with different types. You know what I mean? Like, just...
Well, we could test and see if the sorting is a problem already, right? Because, like, right. So we would expect an array A or B to be able to be used where an array B or A is expected, right?
Yeah.
You'd expect one to be a subtype of the other in both directions. You'd expect them to be equivalent types. So... Yeah.
Exactly.
If that currently works, then maybe it means not a problem, or maybe it means the bug is subtler. I'm not sure.
That's interesting. Yeah.
Like, I wonder if maybe something would fail at runtime because of bad, or, you know, only under certain conditions. Or I'm honestly not super familiar with that back end of the compiler, the reachability stuff, and I've done a little bit of work with the code gen stuff, but I'm having trouble visualizing all the things that could go wrong. Even just with ignoring my PR for a second and thinking about the sorting issue.
Yeah. Yeah.
I guess I should file a separate issue ticket for that to discuss whether that is something that needs fixing or not.
I think it can be just part of this. Or maybe I'm just trying to save on a resource that is not scarce, which is ticket numbers. In which case, please ignore me. Yeah. I'm going to do a quick test here. And see what Mr. Compiler says. So right now, Mr. Compiler is absolutely accepting array string or U32 and array U32 or string as the same type.
The question would be whether there's something subtly wrong in code gen or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or maybe like a match would not... Like you could try doing it in a match expression and in a pattern.
Yep. That's the stuff that we should go through. Would you be willing to add those as test cases to this PR?
Yeah, right? I guess it would have to go in.
Because that would give us confidence that this thing is doing something we expect.
Right. It kind of doesn't feel like it belongs to this PR, but I'll take a look at it. Where would the best place be to put those tests?
I think you could throw them in badpony.cc, in the sense of there's some pony, and some of them are expected to work, some of them aren't expected to work. Bad pony has become a combination of good and bad pony, which I think is in some ways the most hilarious possible outcome. It is a miss. Actually, maybe they do all fail in there, but...
No, yeah. They don't.
Okay.
Some of them succeed. It just become issue ticket pony.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Like... Yeah.
But the issue is that, like, for example, we want to test that the code gen works for those types such that their type descriptor is the same and they get matched correctly, right? Which requires running it at runtime. Or doing it in the code gen test. And
oh, that's true. Yeah, but in which case you could do it with Benoit's JIT stuff.
Yeah, I'll have to familiarize myself with that. I'm not too familiar with it, but I'll add a comment to that effect that needs to be investigated.
All right, cool. Because you're right, it's not just a type checking issue. It's the actual runtime pattern match, and what the heck is it going to match as? And if it works, hey, then we're all happy. Yeah, I think it actually does belong in this PR, because this is what we're trying to show. If those things work, then we want to merge this, because it's nice to do this. I think it's nicer to do this stuff in the parser by far.
Yeah, maybe something else that could be added to this PR would be to also do type intersections in the parser, but also do the, you know, keep folding type intersections in the flatten class, but not having to also structurally flatten them as well.
Yep.
If they were a list.
Yep. That's true. All right, so we've got about 5-10 minutes left, 5 minutes left, and unfortunately I do have to drop off when that hits. The other one that I just wanted to mention is 1715, which is add the refer pass to the compiler. That's not passing right now, but I've been through it, and I really like it. It's really nice to have that extra separation and basically clean up the expert pass. Any possible thing that can be cleaned up out of the expert pass is a win. So this is great. And I know this is producing an unfortunate CI failure on Linux and Windows, but theoretically I think this is great to commit once it's ready. Has anyone else looked at that one? It's not small. If you haven't looked, you might not want to look.
Yeah, don't look into the abyss. This is something I've been trying to do for about a year and finally like sat down and was able to continuously work on it long enough that I didn't forget what I was doing halfway through.
Wow. I'm always super impressed by a commit that adds a new abstract AST token type. Because you know it's a serious commit when that has to happen. All right, cool. Is there anything else people want to go over? Anything? Anyone?
Sorry. Hi. I don't really have anything to talk about, but I just wanted to say hi. So I'm a student at Imperial working with Sophia. I met Sylvan a month ago or something.
Yep.
So I'm working on like a formal model for generics in Pony.
This is very good. I'm so glad. I didn't notice you were here, Paul. Fantastic.
Yeah. Hi. So yeah, I've been trying to break the compiler in every possible way last week. So I made a few issues about that.
Yeah, it's you're doing a good job of it too.
breaking compilers is what one of the best things that formal models is good for. Because you think you find out that you think you know how it works, and then it doesn't when it should. Oh, that's fantastic. Great. So hopefully you'll get a chance to come along to these. And please do feel free to speak up and bring up stuff early. If we seem like we're going down some track and discussing a bunch of stuff, do jump in and just say, hey, I really want to talk about such and such. Always happy to do that. No big deal. We're really just sitting here going through the stuff that Sean marked with discussed during sync anyway.
I mean, like, a lot of what you talk about is more implementation details, which I'm not really too concerned about.
Right, but we're super happy to talk about the other stuff, so please do let us know.
Yeah, for the moment, I don't really have anything to talk about. So this is just that extract test cases issue that I made.
Great.
So the context for this is, so basically we have this model that we prove is sound, but we don't really know how much it matches the compiler implementation.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that we have is to actually implement these typing rules as a completely separate implementation and then see how much of the Pony compiler test suite we can actually pass with these rules. So that gives us an idea of how similar we are to the compiler.
Fantastic. I think that's a very good idea. I think it would also be interesting to implement that alternate implementation in Pony.
Well, so at the moment, I've started writing it in Calc because the point is to, at some point, be able to prove stuff about it.
That's a very good idea.
Using that.
Excellent.
So at the moment, I have a type checker for non-generic Pony working.
Really?
In Calc, yeah.
Ooh, please, please, please send me that. Is it up on GitHub?
Not yet. I can push it just after the call and send a link.
Yeah, do me a favor. Push it and send me the link.
Sure.
Can you send me that as well?
Yeah, yeah. I guess I'll send it to the mailing list.
Great. Yeah, that would be very good. I think this will be a very popular thing for people to look at.
Yeah, so it has, it doesn't have intersection or union types yet, but it has nominal structural subtyping.
Excellent. Just getting structural subtyping in is already a huge win compared to
other
approaches, so that's great.
So Cog, you have to prove that every function terminates, and proving that structural subtyping terminates was quite a hassle.
That sounds not trivial, yeah. That's going to be a proof by induction for Cog, isn't it?
Yeah.
Ow.
Yeah, but I use the same idea that the compiler does, where you push assumption on... Yeah, this is exact, pretty much the same thing as the compiler does.
Excellent. That's good, because that gives us some confidence that what we're doing isn't idiotic.
So yeah, I'm still not quite sure if generic, well, if subtyping with generic is terminates.
Okay.
But I guess I'll see when I implement it.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that's just what I'm working on.
Excellent. I'm sure there will be a strategy for that to be, able to terminate. Theoretically, all the generic types could be rewritten as non-generic types. So yeah, I'm sure you'll get somewhere with it. It not necessarily easily, but
yeah.
You know.
But also, I wanted to say that while you're going, I noticed you were going through, you know, subtype.c and type/cap.c, and if there's anything in there that is really opaque and or is explained in a weird way, feel free to file a pull request that gives better explanations or adds more, changes the names of things to be more, more correct or easier to understand. Those would all be very, very welcome.
You'll also know that there's some type judgments written in sort of half-assed ASCII in there.
Yeah, I've seen that.
Yeah, if you ever want to fix those, change those, whatever, feel free to PR that too.
Sure. So far I've been working kind of part-time on this at the same time as I had lectures and all that.
Yeah.
But starting at the end of this week, as soon as I finish exams, I'll be working full-time on this until pretty much June.
Brilliant.
So yeah, I'll probably be making a lot of more issues.
This is very good.
Coming up.
All right. I just realized that there is one more issue that I'm just gonna be a complete hypocrite and not do what I said and not get off the call, because there's 1708, which is totally a my fault issue, which is nested lambdas can't auto capture free references from the outer scope. Joe, is that something that you were planning to work on, or is it just that you found it?
I wasn't necessarily planning to work on it in the near future, and I hadn't started on it. I was going through and converting one of my projects to use the automatic capturing, and I noticed that that wasn't working as I expected, and I wanted to see if that's something that you think should work.
Yes, it absolutely should work. This is a straight up bug. Okay, cool. I'll just mark this as straight up bug. I think medium priority, medium difficulty. I'm going to assign myself, but if anybody else sees this and goes, hey, I'd love to have a go at that, please do jump on it.
Poor soul.
Yeah, it's my fault for doing free variable closures. All right. Damn thing worked before I tried to fix it. All right. Cool. Thank you, everybody. This is a good call, as usual. Any last-minute stuff before we sign off? Okay, great. See you all next week. Okay.